So this evening I want to talk about awakening. What does that mean? How do we do it? This idea that comes from many spiritual traditions, I think. But really when we think about the Buddhist practice, which over the last several thousand years, there's many forms of Buddhist practice. It's shown up in many cultures and many different schools. And if you start to become interested in Buddhism and Buddhist practices and you're not sure where to begin, God forbid you go to the library or go to Barnes & Noble and look at the section on Buddhism, it can be very overwhelming. Not everybody agrees about everything. There's many different practices and ideas and concepts, some of it quite paradoxical. I've spent the last several years, many years, trying to sort all that out. And so I try to boil things down, bring things down to their lowest common denominator. And that really actually brings us right to this word Buddha, which means to be awake. And when the historic Buddha talked about what had happened to him, or what he'd been through, or what he'd realized, or what he'd experienced, when people would ask him, "What's up with you, man? Like, you seem really peaceful and at ease and kind," and he would say, "I'm awake." This word Bodhi. And people didn't talk in those terms in the time of the Buddha. They didn't speak in terms of being awake. So this idea of waking up or awakening was something that he defined as an experience that he had. And when we think of what we would try to do in Buddhist meditation, Buddhist practice, Dharma practice, we oftentimes get pulled into these very lofty ideas of like enlightenment or the unconditioned or transcendence or really what sounds to me like sort of Buddhist heaven, that there's some way in which we can transcend the mind-body process and we can somehow overcome and override just the difficulty of having to be a person in this world. And this can create what's often known as a spiritual bypass or an avoidance strategy, trying to get away from. And if we look at it from a historical lens in our culture, where and how and when did Buddhism kind of arrive in America? It was really in the post-60s generation. A lot of these first Buddhist teachers went to India in the 60s, the peace love movement, and a lot of confusion and dissatisfaction came out of that time. It was an interesting time, post-Vietnam War time in America. And I think the allure that pulled people into Buddhism was this idea of detachment. And this idea that we could somehow participate in a type of practice that would make it so we didn't have to deal or feel with our difficult emotions, that we could somehow be above it all. And this leaning in this direction has really, I think, pulled many people into a sort of trap. Because it's pretty clear that, at least from what I've noticed in my own life, in my own practice, in my own study of the Dharma, that nothing could be further from the truth. That waking up is actually waking up to your own humanity and the limitations of your own humanity and the pain of the body and the pain of emotion and the pain of the mind, the pain of the relational field, the pain of relationships, our human interactions, the messes that we cause to each other and for each other. You've probably experienced some of that by now. Right? And so to wake up to that, to wake up to what's true, what's really possible, what's doable. And we've had many of these moments, I'm sure, already. This idea, this what I'm speaking to, is probably not a foreign concept. It's that we do have epiphanies and we do have these insights. And throughout our lives, we recognize a certain degree of difficulty or a certain epiphany about something, and we make a change. Say, oh, gee, I really need to stop doing that. This is very destructive. Right? We have a lot of those experiences. So there's nothing really Buddhist about it. It's just something that humans can do. It's something that humans actually are able to do. I've had this very long, strange, at times extremely painful, and at times a very unsuccessful relationship to this Dharma, this thing called Dharma that I talk about. Because I had this, the first awakening I had, or the first transmission I had. Sometimes we call them a Dharma transmission, which is a period in our life where we're really maybe struggling and really confused, and we kind of get a sensibility about things. We wake up to something in a big way, and we have the kind of this big epiphany. And a lot of times those maybe come from a Dharma teaching or a meditation practice or a Dharma teacher, or perhaps just reading a book on the Dharma. They come in a variety of ways. I'm sure you've had those where you kind of had that aha moment about something rather big, or what feels rather big. And I had that when I was 19, which is fairly rare. Most people in America in the early 90s weren't waking up to Dharma. But for me, coming to terms with what I would call, or I think what the Buddha would call, the wisdom of dissatisfaction, which is a theme I like to discuss often, is that we really should not underestimate the power or the value of our own dissatisfaction. There's actually a lot of wisdom that can be gained and a lot of understanding that can be gained by just recognizing and feeling into and acknowledging the difficulty, the suffering, the hardness of life. In fact, the irony is that in many traditions, many religious, spiritual, psychological traditions, that that's what prompts us to do something different. Sometimes, as they say, pain is the great motivator. And most of my early life, my teen years, were the worst years of my life. The age of 12 or 11, from about 11 to 19, I do not want to do that again. My experience had been, I had a lot of death and loss in my early life. A lot of, my sister was killed in a car accident. My girlfriend was also killed in a car accident that I was witness to. I had some other family members and friends sort of die tragically and quickly. That kind of, you're here today, I'm arguing with my sister about what we're watching on TV one night, and the next night she's just gone, and I'm 11. And nobody really discusses that with me or talks to me about that. My parents are unavailable because they're in their own grief and their own suffering around that. And then, like, I'm back at school on Monday, and life just goes on. And I was very lucky. I have what I call Dharma. I have really good Dharma karma. And that I've been very lucky in the teachers that I've met and the people that I've been introduced to and the ways in which I've fallen into this really, what I believe to be very sincere, authentic school of insight or Dharma practice. And one of my high school friends' parents were meditators. and they practice at the Insight Meditation Society, and they were friends with Joseph and Sharon and a whole plethora of teachers there, and they knew that I wasn't quite right. And at the age of 19, I was introduced to a Dharma teacher. Stephen Smith was my first teacher. And I had this really and very strong, real doorway into the Dharma that I've been kind of chasing for 23 years. And it was just really this acknowledgement that to sit down with an adult, because I also had very strong trust issues with authority, and I didn't really trust adults at all. And it was the first time in my life I had a conversation with another human being who really talked to me. I talked to him about my experience and the things I'd been through and how confused and hurt and just dissatisfied and disappointed and felt kind of betrayed by the universe and why do such horrible things happen to me. And he normalized that in a very big way and said, yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in that because that's how it is here. That's how it is for everybody. That there is a lot of tragedy and there's a lot of pain and there's suffering in life. And you're not the only person who's gone through that. And many people go through very difficult things. To some degree, we all go through our fair share along the way. And that can be the prompting of depression. You can collapse into that. You can get filled with doubt and be wounded by betrayal and abandonment and all of these kind of ways we can kind of collapse into that. Or we can wake up and go, oh, wow, that's like what it's like here. That's what it was like for me. I was very relieved to hear that message. I was like, you mean this is, oh, yeah, this is how it is. And in sort of the wisdom of the heart, breaking the heart open into freedom and to breaking the heart open into, oh, this is not just about me. This is about humanity. And gives us the prompting, or gave me the prompting of going, okay, now what am I going to do about that? So I was very kind of relieved to have my experience normalized by somebody. And then a few hours after that, I learned mindfulness practice. I learned Vipassana. I learned two very important things that day. I learned that suffering was not my fault. I learned that it's something that all human beings grapple with to some extent. And I learned that I could change my relationship to my mind through simple practices like we've been working on today. I learned that I could pay attention to something other than the world of my perceptions and my views and my attitudes and my history and my memories and my pain and my loss. And I could just take my attention out of that. I kind of realized it was an exit door. It's like, oh, I don't have to pay attention. I could pay attention to my breathing. I can pay attention to my body. I can be kind to myself and be engaged and feel into that and have some compassion for like, wow, man, like, shit's been hard. Had a really hard time here. And, you know, I feel like I didn't wake up to anything necessarily profound, but for me in my own subjective reality, that was a huge, tremendous shift. Everything changed, right? Everything changed after that. My whole worldview changed. And I don't think this is really any different than what the Buddha woke up to, although he developed a very organized system on how to overcome that, which I've been following with various degrees of success for the last several decades. But it's just this basic idea, right? This very basic idea that we can acknowledge that human beings suffer in ways that seems to be very unnecessary. And you can probably start to diagnose yourself as you sit there. Do you find that to be true? Do you find that you suffer in ways that just seem to be unnecessary? We suffer about things that have never even happened. So That seems to be true and possible and something that happens. And the million-dollar question is, well, can you, is there something that you can do to eradicate that? Is that overcomable? Is that just how it is? Does the mind just wander around into all these domains and these mansions of fear and suffering and loss and confusion? Or is there a way in which we can train our mind and our hearts to not participate in that or to not create that? So, to ask you some kind of questions to reflect on yourself. How did you get here? I wish I had time to interview all of you and say, what were the conditions of your life that put you in the position where you would sign up for a 3-day silent retreat to study some ancient Buddhist practice called Metta Vipassana in hopes that that will have some sort of long-lasting benefit on you and your life? I may be wrong, but I would assume that to some degree, that prompting of that choice or decision has something to do with the fact that you've seen something similar to what I just described in some way. That life seems like it's too hard for me. And I wonder if there's something that I can do about that. I want to understand that. And this is kind of the prompting or the inclining of the mind into this kind of mystery of, is there something that can be done about that? There is something that can be done about that. There's lots of things that can be done about that, but waking up is a lot harder than going to sleep, it turns out. And the other question is, what is it that you're actually looking for? What is it that we're trying to get out of a practice like this? What is it that we're trying to gain? What is the hope? And is it realistic? And to be careful that we don't fall into this trap that our culture has and of like wanting to be above it all, wanting to get past that, wanting to be above that, wanting to have kind of like an emotional lobotomy. We're like, I'm going to meditate so hardcore. I'm never going to get sad again. I'm never going to get angry again. Nobody's going to piss me off again. I'm going to be like above it all. I'm going to be like this guy back here. That guy hasn't moved in like 30 years. In recognizing that idea, that question I always find myself asking myself, when did it all go wrong anyway? The early 90s, man, I really had it going good in the early 90s. My childhood was okay. When did it get so messy? And what can I do about that? Those are good questions. So we find that this awakening is really a process. It's not an event. So awakening, you've had many, many moments of awakening. You've probably had many, many moments of awakening like today. But you don't just wake up and stay awake. Awakening is oftentimes sudden, and for me it was quite sudden in the description that I gave you. Very sudden, very profound, very real. Even now, to think about it, it's a very vivid kind of marker on my timeline of life. It's like a very huge, iconic event. I talk about it often. It was huge for me. And if you look back, you probably have some, if you timelined your life, there'd probably be some pretty big markers of events that put you in a different kind of direction. But waking up to this kind of perspective or understanding things or reading a book on Buddhism or understanding something like the Four Noble Truths or becoming interested in mindfulness or any of this stuff, you're not done there. Just understanding something or seeing something in a certain type of way doesn't necessarily guarantee, and probably will rarely guarantee, that you'll actually be able to experience that fully. So we have to train. And so this sudden awakening is followed by what I call a gradual cultivation, is now we have to gradually cultivate these kinds of qualities, and we have to cultivate awarenesses, and we have to cultivate qualities of the heart, so that way we can continue to kind of stay awake. And really the only two requirements for a path like this or a practice like this is A, that you start, and B, that you continue. That's about it. That's about all you have to do. There's no finish line, at least none that I'm aware of. And the more we practice and the more we train in this way, the benefits come and we gain more confidence. And confidence is a really, really beautiful mind state, emotion. I don't know whether it's a mind state or an emotion, but to me it feels like it's a little bit of both. And I think that confidence as an embodied experience doesn't get the credit that it deserves. Because I don't know about you, but anytime I have to walk through any challenge or any difficulty in my life, if confidence is present, I'm pretty good. And so confidence, this word sada, sometimes translated as faith or trust or maybe even refuge, is what allows us to kind of, I can do this. This faith, this confidence. And if you think about your life, if you look at your life, anything that you've ever done that had any sense of value or meaning or purpose probably took confidence, and then it took some effort. Right? That's how we get degrees. That's how we sustain good relationships. That's how we get trained. That's how we learn. That's how we get educated. That's how we do everything, is we have confidence that we can do something, and then we follow through with the effort that it takes to do it. And then that practice, that experience, comes into some degree of fruition. And that is the same for what we're trying to do here. So we kind of have to trust this practice a little bit. There is maybe even a degree of a bit of a leap of faith. And it was so, I always get such a great education, and I really enjoyed and appreciated the interviews that we had today and the meetings that we had. Because I really, it's very helpful for me to get some insights and some information into kind of what it is that's going on for you on these retreats, and making sure that the instructions make sense. And also, I'm so blown away and so appreciative how many people are just here for the first time. I wish we had more time to talk. I would be very curious and fascinated about what it was that got you here. And it's really, really hard as somebody who's been teaching this stuff and interested in stuff for this for so long, that it's like I really want to make sure that what I'm offering and talking about it is actually landing, is it being true and useful. And because some of this stuff is not so easy to grasp. Some of these ideas are not so easy to understand. So I've been doing this long enough that I have a tremendous amount of trust and faith in the retreat process. And the retreat sort of does actually teach itself. Right. I just try to kind of steer it in a way that feels true and useful. And there's a couple things I want to highlight that the Buddha said about his Dharma. And I think that's important. Because when we talk about what we're practicing here, we are practicing metta vipassana, we're practicing heart qualities, we're trying to access and develop these beautiful spiritual emotions in our system. We're also trying to train our attention to be present, which I'm sure you've started to recognize. It's like, again, trying to catch a chicken in a schoolyard. And so really, I think it's important to just say that the Buddha didn't teach Buddhism. He taught the Dharma. And so the Dharma is really what we've been practicing, this present time awareness, this what is it that's arising in my experience game. Right? Not what could be arising or should be arising. Again, not looking for that place. And the Buddha speaks about that. He says one of the reasons why people don't see Dharma, they don't see what's actually right in front of them, is because they delight and they revel and they cling and they become attached to a place. Which I do, you know, half the day, every day, you know. It's always the next thing. I'm always finding myself perplexed by this nagging internal question of, what do I want to be when I grow up? Right? And I've had many different jobs because of that. And I'm like, when I'm a Buddhist teacher and I get to teach meditation retreats, then I'll be happy. It's like, no. I'm pretty happy, but you know, this is hard work. I thought this was going to be like, I was just going to hang out and ponder the deep questions of the universe by a koi pond with some fish and have some tea. No, I spend lots of time at like airports and getting on the wrong plane and the plane's late, and did not solve all my problems. Although for a period of time I was convinced that it would. So we don't see that which is right in front of us. And he also says this about the Dharma. He says the Dharma is good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, and it's good in the end. So whether you've been practicing this for 10, 15, 20 years, if this is your first retreat, this might even be your first Dharma talk, I don't know. It's good. It's good in the beginning because it teaches us integrity and it teaches us self-kindness and it teaches us metta. And you don't have to be a Zen master. You don't have to have been studying this stuff. Kindness is not a, like, you know, you don't need to go to school for 4 years to study kindness. Kindness is just kindness. You already know what it is. So it's good in the beginning because it just teaches us to be good to ourselves. To be kind to ourselves, to treat ourselves with kindness, to be kind to yourself. Always appropriate to do that. So that's good right there. If that's all you get, that's good. That's a great start. And it's good in the middle because we start to have more meditation. We start to see. We start to have a trackable, measurable practice where we can kind of discern, oh, this is actually working out pretty good for me. Right? And so that's that. The two requirements is the beginning, is just the choice to enter the path, which is maybe what some of you are doing here, and seeing the kindness and the goodness and getting some benefit from turning towards yourself and offering some attention and some care and some goodness and some kindness. And then all you have to do is keep doing that. That's just like what you do. And then over time, you get to measure that and see, oh, this kindness thing doesn't actually stop being useful. And then in the end, of course, is the wisdom that arises out of that. But we want the wisdom first, don't we? Right? We want the wisdom first. We do everything backwards. And he also says this about the Dharma. He says all of his teachings, everything he teaches, the Dharma itself, is what's called ahipasako, which translates as come and see for yourself. Don't take my word for it. Which is what really makes the whole Buddhist endeavor quite interesting and quite countercultural to any other practice or religion that we would engage in, is that when pressed and the Buddha would go and teach and give these discourses and meet in public and teach Dharma, and people would always say, well, like, you know, we get people through here all the time. Deepak Chopra was here last week. Brene Brown was here. Geraldo Rivera. Why should we listen to what you have to say? And he would say, you shouldn't listen to what I have to say. You shouldn't listen to anybody. You should not believe anything until you know for yourself that it's true and that it's useful and that it has a benefit. Which when I hear that, when I heard that early on, I was like, I like this guy, man. Like, I don't like to be told what to do. He's telling me not to listen to him, which makes me want to listen to him. I think the Buddha was very intelligent. He was a master with language. He probably had some of those Jedi mind trick things, like these are not the droids you're looking for. Don't listen to me. I don't know what I'm talking about. And everybody's like, I totally want to listen to you. Right? There's a way in which we kind of have that. I certainly have that. As soon as you tell me not to listen to him, I'm like, well, what do you want me to do? You're totally trustworthy. I trust you now. You seem to have no idea what you're talking about. Right? Come and see. Come and have a look. And that's really what you've been doing all day, really. I mean, I've given you some instructions and some guidance, and you're coming and you're looking and you're seeing. And there's moments of seeing things clearly. I'm sure there's been moments of kindness. There's been moments of awareness. There's been moments of feeling connected authentically to your experience in a way that feels good. And I'm sure there's been some confusion. I'm sure there's been some, like, I really don't want to be here. This body is painful. You've seen all kinds of things. Come and have a look. Come and have a peek. In this noble quest, he talks about this period where he talks about his awakening, what he awoke to. And it's one of the few places in the teachings, in the early teachings, where the Buddha really talks about what it was that he awoke to, what it was that he came to understand. And it's one of these strange places in the teachings where he is kind of having an internal dialogue with himself, which is kind of interesting. So you kind of get a sense of what it's like inside the mind of the liberated Buddha, where he's like, And he says, I considered, it starts off, he says, I considered this Dharma that I've reached, this Dharma that I've woken to. He says that it's quiet, it's excellent, it's fine, it's hard to wake up to, it's difficult to see, it's sensed or felt by the wise. He also says in another place where he talks about the visible Dharma, he says that it's actually visible, he says it's inviting, it's immediate, it's uplifting. And that it's a kind of sensibility. It's a way of, what's going on here? Waking up to that which is going on here. But then he says it's really hard to see because people delight and revel in their place. And those who delight and revel in their place are covered with a mass of darkness. And they do not see this Dharma. And when he says that it's difficult to see, I used to think that he meant it was difficult to see because you had to, like, be a really good meditator. Like, if you had to really get, you had to get all your faculties lined up just right if you wanted to see the Dharma. He's not saying that at all. But I think what he means by hard to see, I think he means it's painful to see. And part of waking up is waking up to the big, perhaps bitter truth about ourselves that we actually don't want to see. You know what I'm talking about? The parts of your mind, the parts of your experience, you're like, yeah, I ain't trying to see that. I'm not trying to know about that. And this is the cause of so much suffering. And in Buddhism, they call that ignorance, which I think is too derogatory of a term, but I think it's actually denial. Is that we do We don't want things to be the way they are. We don't want things to be the way they've been. Because it's hard to look at the uglier, more challenging, more difficult parts of our humanity or our experience. And what do we do in our culture and our world is we pretend. How are you? Oh, good, I'm great. So good. Everything in my life is so perfect and great. Right? And we have to do that. We wear these masks. We pretend. We don't have these. We kind of keep these parts of ourselves tucked away. And when we start practicing and you sit here all day, what do? They're like, cool, it's my, I'm getting a chance to arise. Right? We talked about this in the interview. One of the ways that I think about mindfulness, the wisdom of mindfulness, is that our awareness has a reflective quality to it. It's just actually like a mirror. And if you hold up, if you have a mirror and you put anything in front of the mirror, all it does is reflect that image back precisely. Like if I look at this and I look at the image of this in a mirror, they're totally the same. It doesn't distort. It doesn't pretend. It doesn't lie. It doesn't manipulate. It doesn't rationalize. It doesn't justify. It just says, it is what it is. Here you go. Have a look. And you're like, oh man, I've been really trying my hard my whole life not to look at that. You know, where's the mindfulness switch? Shut it off. Shut it off now. I don't want to see it. Right? It's painful to see. It's hard to look at. And then he's thinking about this. So the Buddha's like realizing all the things I'm saying. And he's in his own mind. And he's he has this choice. He's like, he's actually stuck with this choice of, is he going to teach or not? So this whole noble quest, the question to teach, this whole teaching, is the Buddha actually waking up, realizing the reality of reality, the reality of our humanity, what's possible, what's not possible, how much work it's going to take. And he's thinking to himself, I'm not going to teach this. Nobody's going to want to hear this. People are not going to get it. They're not going to understand. They're not going to want to hear it. And he was inclined to not teach. And then the story gets a little bit weird because some Brahma or some heavenly person comes down from some other realm and has a conversation with the Buddha, which I actually don't think happened, but I don't know, I wasn't there. And tells him, he has this idea. He says, no, you should totally teach the Dharma because some people will totally get it. And they say, there are people who have little dust in their eyes. They're not totally sandbagged. They have just a little bit of dust in their eyes. And they'll actually appreciate what you have to say, and they'll understand the practice, and you'll be able to actually help some people. And then this Pali term, anukampa, comes into being. And they say that the Buddha taught the Dharma out of compassion for all living beings. And he even said to himself, he said, people aren't going to understand me. It's going to be tiring and vexing for me to teach this Dharma. He's like, man, it's going to be a real drag trying to explain to people. You should sit with your suffering and meet it with compassion. Nobody wants to hear it. They want to know how to fix it. And out of compassion for the world, he set forth and inclined his mind, inclined towards teaching. And we have this sort of 2,600-year-old game of telephone that has kind of worked itself out right here into this room, into this moment, into this kind of experience. So we don't just wake up and be done. And so when we think about the two camps or the two maybe components, is that Buddhist teachings are usually broken down into wisdom and to compassion. in that we need to do both. And we need to understand the limitations of our humanity. We need to have some understanding for what drives our destructive behaviors. What is it that drives our suffering in our own minds and the ways that we think about ourselves and the world and other people? And we have to learn how to respond. We need to learn how to hold that. We need to learn how to develop the heart of that. And this is where it gets really hard, because culturally speaking, I think, is that especially growing up in the American culture and the education system and the way that probably most of us here, is that we really, really value wisdom. Wisdom is like the real deal. We just really want to be very wise. We want to be really smart. We want to have knowledge. And that actually, that's kind of the religion of the modern world, isn't it? Smarts, intelligence, IQ, wisdom, understanding, all these kinds of ideas are very revered and valued. And the problem with suffering, I think, is you just can't outsmart it. This is not a practice about being smart or clever. And if I just understood things properly, then this difficult part of my experience would go away. That doesn't work so good, I've found. And then we end up being those people who have all the right answers to all the wrong questions. So this dharma that he awoke to, or the way that he talks about the noble quest, we could even say the question, is that really this practice is about asking questions. It's much more about asking questions than it is about having an answer. Because I don't know about you, as soon as I have the answer, you know what I stop doing? I stop asking the question. Because I got the answer now. And I cling to that answer. The answer is the end of the question. So you better be very, very clear and very, very sure that you have the answer. And you better be even more clear and sure that you're asking the right question. And this really pulls us into the heart. And it's hard to talk about that, I think, because I call it the heart because it seems to be the most colloquial way we talk about difficult emotions. Or like if we look at art and music and movies and literature, you know, we as a culture in the English language have really dedicated a lot of our time and energy to creating poetry and artistic creativity, iconicity around heartbreak. Does everybody know what heartbreak is, or do I need to explain that? Right. As we all get our hearts broken in strange and unusual and sometimes even very traumatic and horrible ways. And then what happens is we want to try to, it's like this. I call it the wound that seeks the arrow. Is that my heart's been broken in so many ways in such a particular style that I actually try to protect it now, and I have all these bad strategies and all these ways that I become defended against the world. And this is why I love the work of some of the people in our secular culture, like Brené Brown. I don't know if you know who Brené Brown is, but she's pretty awesome. And really talking about vulnerability, which is really what the Buddha is talking about, is we are vulnerable. Your mind is vulnerable, your emotion is vulnerable, your body is vulnerable. You can only protect so much and so well. And the irony, I think, here, when we think about things like compassion, is that actually the heart's strength, the strength of the heart, lies in its weakness and lies in its vulnerability. The reason why the heart can become so strong is because it's so vulnerable. And again, back to the original idea, don't underestimate the wisdom of your own dissatisfaction. Because in that waking up, part of waking up isn't just this cognitive waking up to understanding the limitations of our humanity or what we can expect, but it's actually waking up to what are we going to do about this heart that's vulnerable, that gets hurt, that also has all this strength, which is the metta side of metta vipassana for me. These metta practices, which is half of the practice. So there's the two questions, the two great questions we could ask in meditation practice. There's the wisdom question. We've been working with that today, perhaps a little bit. What is it that's arising in my experience? That's that vipassana, inward seeing. What is it that arises? All kinds of things arise. Sounds arise, thoughts arise. But actually, one thing I've noticed is the more I meditate and the more I concentrate and the more I'm able to sit in the container of these kinds of experiences, what starts to arise is kind of that old wound or that old part of myself that I don't really want to see. It has its kind of weird, strange way of sneaking in. You're like, wait a minute, what is that? I thought I dealt with that. I went to therapy 5 years ago and dealt with that. I'm in recovery, I dealt with that. I'm a person who doesn't, I don't deal with that anymore. All this kind of unfinished business shows up, right? And it shows up because we're, to some degree, we're sort of asking for trouble in these meditation retreats because we're making all this space, right? We're making all this space. We've cleared out all the, at least external, digital, schedule, time, clutter. We've made all this space. And then we've been spending some time inserting and bringing some metta, some kindness, some friendliness into it. And then all these parts that we've banished from the kingdom of ourself go, oh, cool, like it's totally safe to come in now. And we're like, no. Stay out of here. And internally, internal family systems, which is a Western therapeutic modality that's based on Buddhist psychology, they call that the exile parts. And they're the parts of myself that I have banished from the kingdom of myself. I've kind of neatly locked them away in a room down in the basement of my heart. And we just don't like go down there anymore. That's just like, let's just leave that where it is. And I've done that a lot. And that's when I talk about spiritual bypass, that's what I mean, is that the ways in which we think that we've already dealt with it, and it's water under the bridge, and let sleeping dogs lie, and it doesn't bother me anymore. It was a long time ago. I worked through that. And when we come into this dharmic, non-linear framework, that exiled part of ourself doesn't really care about any of that. Right? And these memories, these parts of our perceptual database that we have, of our histrionic experience, they start to kind of make their way in. They start to arise in our experience. And we have the opportunity to recognize that, and we have the opportunity to change the relationship to that and to say, okay, like, I'm ready for you now. I'm attending with interest. You know, what do you need? Me and Andrew have both studied with a Buddhist monk named Ajahn Sucitto, who's a Thai forest master, who's the most liberated human being that I've ever sat in front of. And he talks about this practice of, what is it? What is this? How is it? And what does it need? What is it? How is it? And what does it need? And that we do have these aspects of our experience that show up where it's like, we don't even want to know what it is, right? What is it? I don't know. And this is where we had some conversation in the interviews about this today, where something like concentration or mindfulness of breathing can create a type of spiritual bypass, because I benefited greatly from that aspect of the practice, and I really value it, and I think it's important. But what I would do is these pesky little visitors would show up, and I go, I'm back to the breath. I'm back to the breath. Like, I don't want to know what you are. I just want you to go away, and I'm just going to sit here and breathe. You stay over there. I'm over here. Let's just keep it cool. I don't want to deal with you. I've already dealt with you. And, you know, you can't do that. That creates all kinds of side effects. That part of the experience, it starts showing up in all these other strange and unusual behaviors. Right? So I finally, okay, well, what is it? What is this? How is this? And that's that affective feeling, the affect. I love this word, affect. I'm affected by my experience. There's a feeling, there's a vedana, there's a, how does this feel? There's usually an emotional component. And this is where it gets really tricky. Is there a sense of sadness associated with what this thing is? How is it? How is sadness? How is that in the field? How is that in the body? Is it anger? Is it fear? Is it shame? Maybe it's joy. How is it? How is this experience? How is this part of my experience? I'm allowing it in. Oftentimes in meditation practice, one instruction you'll probably never hear me say is let go. I think that we're like, let go, cool, I'll totally let go of that. See ya. But actually, it's much more challenging to let in. How do we let in? We let these in. What does this need? What does this need? Right? And start seeing it, feeling it, being kind and friendly, and really trying to move away from that subjective sting, that narrative that we have about that. And that self, you know, that self, that 10,000 versions of self, the sad self, the angry self, the abandoned self, the nobody loves me self, the I'm better than self, the shit never goes my way self, why does this always happen to me self, nobody understands me self. Right. How many of, it's just endless, endless, endless versions of that. Which one of them is you? Which one of those are you? And when we start to be able to, how is it, the emotional component of that, we start to see that all these emotions have a story, they have a narrative, they have a message, they have a story to tell. Right? Are we sitting here willing to listen to the story that the sad self has to tell you about you and really needs to tell its story? No, I ain't hearing that noise, man. I came here to meditate. It's nice. I'm going to go for a walk in the woods. Right? And we cut off. We push away. We don't want to wake up to that. We want to stay asleep to that. So the problem with waking up is you keep doing it and you don't finish. And it's this kind of Buddhist perspective. I'll speak more about tomorrow night, about equanimity, about understanding and really waking up to joy. Waking up to all of the joy and all of the beauty and all of the goodness. And there's so much in this world that is just amazing and beautiful and great, that we should appreciate and that we should learn to pay attention to and not take for granted. The mystery of life, this, how good, the question, how good can we do as humans? How good can we do? There's that. And there's also the sorrow. There's loss and there's pain and there's difficulty and there's, you know, there's both. And the mind doesn't like that. The mind likes one thing, which it makes my job very hard because everybody here wants to know, just, Dave, just give me the one thing. You're the teacher. I've been asking teachers for years, what's the one thing? So I like this Buddhism thing. I'm into this whole Dharma thing. But dude, can you just like give me the one thing that I can just take when I leave and bring home with me and just do that one thing? Too much. What's the one thing that leads to liberation? And perhaps it turns out that liberation is the mind that's no longer looking for the one thing. The place. They were back to the place. Where's the right place? Where's the right place to be, the right person to be, the right conditions to have? That's what we're driving. The mind is driving us out constantly to that. And again, we're always overlooking this Dharma, this ground, whatever you want to call it, this reality of reality. Always looking over the fence. It's over there. It sucks over here on my side of the fence. You know, the grass is always greener on the other side, right? And that's what gets this whole suffering psychology thing going. Is we're always gazing outward to find the better. And so we stop doing that. And we look at what's here, what is this? Body, heart, mind. What is going on here? What is the story of my joy? What is the story of my sorrow? How good can I do? And we know through science and through emotions that your ability to access sorrow and sadness in that side of the emotional realm is directly correlated to your ability to access the joy and the happiness and the connection. It's that their emotions is actually a fair system. Either you're totally numb to your emotions or you have access to your emotions. Either you have access to kindness or you don't. And if you have access to compassion, you also have access to sadness and to those difficult experiences. You don't get to selectively numb. You don't get to selectively choose. You don't get to sit here and open up the console and get the mix dialed and just how you like it. Turn down the pain. Imagine that. Turn down the pain in the legs. Turn up the energy. Turn, you know, it's like if we had like the remote control for existence. Someone's probably trying to make that right now. You know, Apple, some crazy dude somewhere is in some back room trying to figure out how to install some plant behind my ear so I can have control to the existential control panel of this realm. Right? You know someone's trying to figure that out. You're trying to figure it out right now in your own sort of, you know, not constructive way. And so when we try to liberate the heart, so again, it's kind of this paradox of joy and sorrow, in that the heart's strength lies in its weakness. It's the vulnerability and the courage and all of that aspect of the heart that allows us to, gives us the strength to have the life that we want, to be the people that we actually really want to become, and to not get trapped and held back by our fear or our doubts and all of that stuff. And so we engage in this awakening practice. And so we try, or I attempt to offer you this metta vipassana training where we learn these really, really useful skills, or at least I found to be these radically useful skills of just being at ease and trying to be friendly and trying to just be safe and okay and just arriving into this existential framework with some degree of like, all right, like it's kind of hard here, but I think I'm going to be all right. And then beginning to recognize and to become aware of all the difficulties in our life, to just acknowledge them, to own them, to reflect. And then to respond or to hold those experiences in a way that doesn't cause suffering. And it turns out that well-being is a skill that you can learn. And so this really great emergence of science and Dharma and all this work that's being done in the field of contemplative neuroscience, and they're asking the question. They're not asking the DSM-5 Diagnostic Manual of Psychological Disorder questions. They're actually going, how good can people do? How well can human beings do? And what are the things, what are the strategies, what are the practices that lead to human flourishing? And maybe we should teach and learn and practice those. So I offer that for your reflection this evening. I appreciate your attention. And let's just sit quietly for a few minutes.